I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be back at Sunday night. I used to come here all the time years ago. Okay, so I'm a rainy day alcoholic today. I'm whatever the weather's doing. I'm sober. I had a great day today. I think that's the payoff for staying in the program and having consistent sobriety, is that there are days that are perfect. They're not that often, but some days are perfect. And today was perfect for me. I woke up in the country, and it was a beautiful sunny day. It was hot, and my whole day I did whatever I wanted. You know, I went swimming. They had these people I was staying with, they're friends of ours, that I would not have known or never have met if I wasn't in AA. Because I sponsored this lady from her first day, the first day she came to a meeting. And I don't sponsor anymore, but we've become very, very close. So, you know, they live in pretty opulent surroundings in the country, and I rolled into the pool, and they have a big, beautiful pool on their property, and I'm swimming, and they're Canada geese. They have ponds, and they have bridges, and they got everything. And I'm swimming there, and I see the Canada geese landing on the lawn, and it's hot, and I'm in the pool, and I'm just swimming along, and I'm thinking, man, ain't sobriety great, you know? I mean, I don't have a headache anymore. The weekends were permanent migraines for me. Usually I was either in a migraine or drinking to get rid of a migraine. And I said to her, because she's a couple of years in the program, and I said, isn't this what, you know, 11 years of sobriety looks like, which is what she has? And she said, and who would have imagined? Because when I came to AA, I thought, you know, I didn't want to be here and I was better than everybody, but I knew I had to stop my life in the way. The kind of life I was leading was basically boozing all the time. And I said to her, you know, when I came to AA, I just thought I was going to stop drinking. I thought that was going to be, you know, I was living an existence that was about that high, and all I wanted to do was just keep living that existence but not drink, because I didn't know anything else. I didn't know that my life would expand. I just thought I wouldn't drink anymore. And for me, the way I lived was, you know, I had to have a lot of people around me all the time. I was a very lonely person. So if I had lots of people around me, I wasn't lonely anymore. But I was always lonely inside. And I didn't have any money ever. I mean, whether I worked or not, I never had money. When I was broke, I drank off other people. And when I worked, I drank off other people. But I just spent the money anyway. And I never knew how much I was earning. And I lived off my credit line. I had a $500 credit line because my bank manager was a boozer. I'm not going to say he was an alcoholic. But we drank together. We drank together. So I went to him. And I hit him up for, I thought, a lot of money, $500, to get through the summer. So he gave me a credit line. And I used to live on that credit line. I was always living in the red. I always lived in the red. But if I had $50 left on that credit line, everything was cool, you know? All I needed was to have the rent paid and get my hands on that $50. Because, you know, I just needed to know I could get to happy hour. Because once we got to happy hour, who knew what was going to happen later? I lived in a perpetual state of adventure. Because I never knew it was going to happen, you know? And I was always up for it, whatever was going to happen. So money to me just represented a way of getting to the bottom, you know? So I worked. I think I figured out I should work because I figured out that I didn't want to marry. When you married, you gave away your freedom and your feet were nailed to the floor. So, you know, why marry? But I just needed the money to drink. And, you know, I look at my life and that was the size of my life. And I thought it was full of possibility because you never knew what was going to happen in the bar. After the first couple of drinks, somebody might show up, you might go somewhere else. But basically, I lived Mountain Street, Mackay, or Stanley Street, Mountain Street, Mackay. We started out on Stanley Street, moved to Mountain, Mackay. And you couldn't go anywhere after Mackay because Guy Street was the end of the English drinking territory as far as I was concerned. And I thought that, you know, that was all my life was going to be for a long time. And this is an illness that is degenerative. It never gets better. It always gets worse. So in the beginning when I was living in NDG with my parents and I went downtown, I thought that I was on this immense, this wonderful cultural trip somewhere. I was going to wind up being a star. I mean, it was inevitable, right? I was going to be a star. And I drank with all these people who worked for Le Devoir, and they were film people. I mean, they were actors, and they did this, and they did... So by association, of course, I was doing all that stuff, too. I wasn't doing any of it, but by association, I thought, you know. And I was nuts from a long time ago. I mean, I think when I was young, I don't know if I was a good kid or a bad kid. I know I was extremely shy. I was painfully shy. painfully, painfully shy. And I grew up in a house where I was happy. I remember having a childhood that was very happy. I would run out of the screen door every day, and you know, I had no responsibilities, which is perfect for someone like me. And then my mother had a stroke, and my father hit the bottle. Maybe he was drinking at home, I don't know, but everything changed. And then the cases of beer started to come in. Then the fight started, and then you know, the dishes broken, and people screaming. And I was reading Oprah magazine. I can afford to buy Oprah magazine now. And she said, "What happened at your childhood table? What kind of scene was it? What kind of emotions?" And I'm thinking sarcasm and yelling. That's all I remember. And food being thrown around. You know, like I didn't have a very happy or serene life after I was about 9 years old. It just was horrible. And I just retreated into myself and into my own imagination. And I did very well at school because by then I was trying to get approval and recognition from my teachers. And I was like, you know, what do you want me to do? And they would pay attention to me. So I would spend longer and longer times at school. I'd be at school at 8 in the morning. I wouldn't come home from basketball, badminton. I mean, you name it. I was doing everything. So I was till 10 o'clock at night. And I was in the, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan, the drama, selling UNICEF cards. I don't know how I had time for school. Then the summer, the torrid summer of 19 whatever happened, and I went off and got a job at, I wanted to be a performer, and I'd go for auditions, and they would laugh at me, and it wasn't very good. And I went to a resort in the north, up north, in the Laurentians to be a children's counselor, and this is where my reality, where reality and what Sharon perceives is what's supposed to happen, this is when the gap started. They hired me as a children's counselor, so I go out shopping for cocktail dresses because I'm going to a resort. And so I brought this suitcase full of cocktail dresses. And the first night I was there, I remember going to the only place on the estate that, you know, I heard noise, and it was a bar. And I remember going in and sitting down, and the waiter that came up to serve me was this bedroom-eyed guy I had met on the bus, and I thought, I've been chosen, you know, he came to my table. Here's the beginning of my egocentricity. And I just didn't know what to order, so I just ordered the only word I knew, which was a screwdriver, because I had to always look like I knew what I was doing. And so he brought one, and then he brought another one, then he brought another one. Unbeknownst to me, I'm on the social staff, I'm allowed to drink for free. And I remember thinking when I got up and the whole room spun around that I was not at all alarmed. In fact, I was excited because my reality had now altered. You know, I mean, it's called being dizzy. But I thought it was just fantastic. And I remember it was raining that night, and I'm the last one to leave the bar. I've drunk like a pig, and I get a guy to carry me home in his arms. I thought it was so romantic, you know. And why was he carrying me in his arms? Could it be that I was too drunk to walk? But I didn't see anything that way. My perception of events was always very romantic and very dramatic. So that summer I changed. Something in me changed. And I went back to the high school. I no longer got in line. I no longer did what people said. I was the president of the school, so I would excuse myself from class to go smoke in the bathroom. I mean, I have business, student council business. And I started that life of the double life. You know, on this side I have these titles and I'm supposedly doing this, but on the other side I've started to smoke now and I'm in the girls' bathroom puffing on Du Maurier. And this same bedroom-eyed waiter, in, you know, that he had dumped me for a thinner girl, I wasn't going to have that, no, none of that. So I pursued him with faxes and flowers, and duh, he asked me out again. And he took me to a club downtown. And I had that feeling, I spent the week getting ready, I had my eyebrows plucked, I bought a new dress, my hair was out to here. And we went to this little nightclub, and the waiter came to the table, and again, you know, I was faced with, well, what do I want to drink? So I said to him, whatever he's having, you know, I don't... And I drank that night, and I made a decision that night that this is where I want to be. The low light, the soft snare drum in the background, the music, and a man, you know. And the scene was complete. I was 17, I think, at the time, 16. And I made that decision that this is the life I wanted to lead. And really, after that, it's just a bunch of facts where I always had a man and a beer and some kind of form of music. I mean, it went from, you know, jazz to hardcore acid rock or whatever. It didn't matter. I was in my element. And I think what happened, I'm not going to analyze, you know, why I loved drinking so much. I just loved it. I loved it because it liberated me from being ugly and stupid. And that's it, you know. I was ugly and stupid, and no one could tell me anything different. And I used to say to my mother, am I fat? And she'd go, you're pleasingly plump. Well, that was not the right answer. So booze transformed me. I could perceive of my, I could see myself the way I really wanted to be, and I became that person. And that was it. From then I went, you know, I went to university. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to university. I remember going to my father and saying, I want to go to McGill, and he said, what? We put $100 away for you at birth to become a secretary. You know? And I was like, no, I don't want to be a secretary. I never learned how to type after that. I went to McGill, and I, you know, I spent most of the time doing other things other than being in class. I found all the societies where they were, had the heavy drinkers. You know, I worked on the McGill Daily, and they drank beer like, you know, big garbage cans. Fridays when the paper went out, you know, we would just, like, suck it back. I hated the taste of beer. Hated it. But, you know, after four or five, I don't know, you don't notice anymore, and I became a party girl. I became such a party girl that we would go to these frat parties, and they would say to me the next day, wow, you were so much fun, Sharon. You were wearing that lampshade on your head. You were sliding down the banister. And I'd say, no, wasn't that nice? You know, they noticed me. I mean, I don't even remember. And I'm only 18 years old, and I'm already having extensive and long-term blackouts. But because I thought that was, you know, cute, I guess, the summer of 67, friends of mine had quit school and got jobs at a Midnight Magazine or one of those yellow newspapers, and I would go to their house for parties all summer. And things started to happen. I started to deny what was happening. I mean, I remember once slugging back a bottle of beer and saying, were those five or six cigarette butts I just swallowed? And I said, no, no, you know? Like, I would just deny what was happening to me. And I started to get into sort of psychedelic drugs at the time. And nobody was wearing shoes in that summer, so I would go to all these places without shoes. And I was arrested once, you know, when I was in an altered state. And none of it meant anything to me. I wasn't scared. I just thought it was so much better than the nice little safe life I had in NDG. And I finished university, and I thought I was so bright. I squeaked out with a 52.1 or something. I thought I was so bright to pass with no work, that I decided I didn't have to work full time. That all, you know, I would go to these interviews. I could have had a job like that those days, and I would go to these interviews, and I'd be in these offices, and my heart would sink because all I could see was conformity, you know, conformity and people. I couldn't deal with people. I couldn't have people around me. So I became a freelancer, and I did all kinds of stuff. I wrote, you know, scripts for people. I did all kinds of things. And I just wandered around the... I lived right down here. I, you know, my idea of a good life was not have to pay rent. And if you don't get married, how else can you not pay rent, right? I didn't want to be a professional call girl, so I had considered it. But I lived right down here. I didn't pay any rent. It was some atelier for screenwriters and playwrights. And so I was basically the janitor lady, but I called myself the liaison officer. And I mean, I basically swept the floors and kept the place open, and I paid no rent. So I mean, life was perfect, right? I figured the problem with North America is people love money too much. So here I am rationalizing abject poverty. I mean, I didn't even have money to eat. I didn't have money. I never bought groceries. And around 4 o'clock, the world would start to, you know, buzz a bit. I'd say, oh, all those poor suckers are going home, all those 9-to-5ers, right? I mean, the ones driving cars and living in high-rises. But aren't they pathetic, right? They're all doing what they're told to do. And look at me. I'm free. Free from what? I mean, I used to go and hustle drinks at the Swiss Hut, steal the boiled eggs from the bistro in Mountain View. I had no clothes. I had ever gone for a job interview. I had no clothes. So I used to go out in the costumes of the theater department when I had to go to drink. One night I was Spanish, one night I was English. My drinking had progressed to the point, and I'm talking about the denial of it. My drinking had progressed to the point that when I would walk home at night along St. Catherine Street, the cars were cruising me. I'm 21, 22 years old, not bad looking. The cars were cruising me along St. Catherine Street, and I would have to walk with my hand along the brick wall so that I would not be doing that. So I would look like I was like walking straight, and I'm 22, and I have no clue the state of my alcoholism. Flash forward, I knew one thing. You have to pay your rent or you're an alcoholic. I knew that. That was a rule, but I got somewhere. So I always paid my rent. Always, always paid my rent. And flash forward, I'm at university now. I liked university because you didn't have to work, basically. And, you know, you got money from the government, and, you know, you had some role in society, and you would say you're a student. But I was in graduate school at the time, and I had secured a duplex on NDG. I had sold my job back to my school board, and I was basically a graduate student with no money, but I had 3 months' rent left in my account, so I said to the, this is another drama, right? I mean, I just lived these roles. I sucked them up. The girl who was giving me the duplex said, they don't really like, you're Italian, they're very old-fashioned, they don't really like women living alone, they think it's a crime against God. So I was ready, right? So I go to his house, and he says, is it legal for a woman to sign a lease? And I said, but I'm engaged. I had gone to Ogilvy's, I got a very expensive-looking stone thing, you know? I paid a lot of money for a $22.50 or something. And I'm waving it around, it's like, I said, I'm engaged, am I engagé? You know, he's busy with his business, and he's moving in later. And he's looking at me like, oh, he's not sure, you know. So I slipped the 3 months' rent across the table as a money order. And when he put his finger on it, I went, yes. And he said, I guess it's okay. So with my last 3 months of money in my account, I moved into this apartment. And this was the apartment that I finally bought him in. And it was all white. And there were days when I would get home. I had no furniture. I'd sit by the phone and I'd say, I'm in a mental hospital, but at least I'm renting it, you know, because it's mine. And I got sort of part-time work at the university, and I'm going into this because at one point, you know, I went from month to month with my little money order for my rent, because that was my only distinction between people in the Douglas and me, was that I paid my rent. I had my money order in my hand. I had a question to ask a friend. I took him to a bar. I bought him a drink. And I had a drink, and then he saw my question, and then he said, I have to go now, I have no more money, and I didn't have any money either. I said, oh, God, but you know, once I've had the drink, eh? Once I've had the drink, the allergy, they call it an allergic reaction, once that liquid goes into my stomach, I can then not choose not to have another one. I didn't know this, but that one beer was all it took. I had that one beer, and the allergic reaction to alcohol, meaning that I don't have one or two and feel good and want to go home, the allergic reaction that I have to keep going. And I said to him, oh, what the hell? And I cashed my rent check at the bar. And he gave me the whatever my amount of cash was, and that's all the money I had in the world. And I saw myself do that. I was fully breaking all the rules. Alcoholics pay their rent. Alcoholics don't drink alone. And I gave him the rent check. And he cashed it, and we went on drinking that night. And that was the beginning of the end for me. I mean, it didn't take much longer, but these things that were scaring me, because I was responsible for myself. No one was looking after me. I did wind up living in a rooming house. I did get attacked in that rooming house, and I was beaten, and it's ruined my drinking. It absolutely ruined my drinking, because I used to drink alone with men, and I couldn't do it anymore. I would be drinking with someone, and I would see the whole scene happen over again. And it was important, I think, for me, who was invincible. I drank because I needed to feel that sense of I am invincible, and no one can harm me, and no one can hurt me, because no one can touch me, because I'm invincible. And that incident cured me of that and gave me a thing I never had in my life, fear. I started to feel fear. And I connected the fear and the end of my life with booze. It was the first time I made that connection, that my life would be taken, or I would take my own life through alcohol. Or worse, I would go blind. Because I used to drink, pretty much a marathon drinker, and I wear contact lenses, and I would wake up and I'd have these scratched corneas where the whole eye is ulcerated. It feels like 1,000 shards of glass. And you know what I would say? Oh, it's a good time to rest. You know, put an eye patch on, pull down the blinds. Your body's telling you to rest. I mean, my body was telling you you're going to go blind. You know? So that incident terrified me. And I think at that point I asked a friend, could I move in with her? And this was, I think now I have to go ask her, but I think, you know, that this was a setup, because I was home that morning. We had been out drinking. I was using her credit card, another bad sign. I didn't use other people's credit cards to drink. All this shoddy behavior, I started to notice it around me, and it was all about getting more alcohol. And a phone call came to her house, and they asked for Sharon. My name's Sharon. I said, I'm here. And she goes, no, the other Sharon. Tell her I'm speaking at a meeting tonight. And when my friend came home, I said, well, who's this Aviva, and she's speaking? What kind of a meeting is it? She said, she's speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I said, can I go? I never planned to go to AA. The guys I drank with, they would disappear. And people would say, well, they went to AA. And we never saw them again. Or they'd come back with the questions. And we'd sit at the bar and I'd fill in the questions. And I'd go, well, this makes everybody an alcoholic. I answered all of them correct. This is really strict, this place. Really strict. Anyway, I went to this meeting, and this woman was up there, and she was emitting, and she was dramatic, and she did something to me, and I went up to her and I said, I might have a problem. It's a possibility that I have a problem with drinking. And she goes, give me your number. She didn't say, here's my number. She said, give me your number. And she took my number. I went home to my friend Sharon. You know what, 20 years ago, I just took my 20-year cake, and about last summer I figured out this was all a setup. Because my friend Sharon wasn't an alcoholic. She didn't even drink. Why was she going to an AA meeting? I think she set it up because she knew this woman from another, relationship of some sort. Anyway, I went to the meeting. I told this lady, here's my phone number. And the woman started to phone me. She started to phone me every day. And, I was so moved. I was so touched that when I would hang up the phone, I would cry because no one phoned me anymore. I was so lonely that I was totally on my own all the time. And I said to her, maybe I should go to another meeting, or where do you have these meetings? And so I went downtown. I went to Mundy Central downtown, and I liked it. I liked the buzz and the people. I mean, I wasn't an alcoholic, but I liked the meeting. And I went a couple of times, and I was very blessed because I got home one night, and I realized I had been looking for this thing all my life. And it was really what my parents had taught me, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It was a sense of goodness, a sense of, I wouldn't call it spirituality, I didn't have that kind of vocabulary. It was just a sense of that my parents wanted me to be a good person. And suddenly I was in this meeting where people seemed to care for each other. They'd say, how are you doing? And I'd remember their name and their face because, to be kind to me at that point in my life was the most beautiful thing in the world. I would cry. I would cry because I hadn't known that kind of kindness in so long. So I started to go to Mundy Central a lot, and Aviva was there. She was a member. And I joined that group. And, my process through AA just became sitting in the front row, being bored with the speaker, reading the slogans. And they would talk about the slogans. And I remember I was on the street, and I was going into the liquor commission at the corner of St. Catherine and St. Matthew, because that was my liquor commission. And a woman cut me off, and she went in ahead of me, and I was mad. And I looked at her, and suddenly there, but for the grace of God, go I, came into my head. She's going in there for you, Sharon. You're in AA now, remember? Because the power of my habits, right? My 5 o'clock, they get ready at 4 o'clock. The power of the drinking in my life was such a habit that, I was happy, I thought, there, but for the grace of God. I must have heard it at a meeting. And she went in, she bought the bottle, and I didn't go in there. So I was very thirsty the first summer because it was a long, hot summer. And they kept coming out with new designer beers, and I was so mad, like, because I was on top of the alcohol scene. I was new, that's new, that's new. And they came out with this beer, and I was really pissed off, because I couldn't try it and tell everybody I had tried it. I wasn't, 100% in here. I mean, I hadn't really accepted I was an alcoholic. I could admit it, but I couldn't accept it. So I started to drink 2%, or no beer. I started to drink no beer. And I brought a bunch to a friend's place. They were all alkies, They weren't in AA, though. And they said, Sharon, there's alcohol in this beer. No, there isn't. I'm knocking them back at about 6 minutes. There's alcohol in this. We can tell. Like, we're drinkers. No, there isn't. And I started to go and get this beer. And one day I was on my way, and I ran into two AA members who were going to the Calypso jump up. And they said, come with us. And I realized, you see, the AA members cut me off and going in for the near beer. And I was lying. I mean, I knew underneath that there was alcohol in there. I was a big liar to myself and everybody else. So October, I didn't know it was Halloween. Go out of town. Don't take any numbers. I don't really ever listen to much. Go and spend the weekend with my best drinking buddy in Kingston, and tell her how wonderful AA is all weekend. How wonderful it is. Don't have a drink of alcohol. And Sunday night she makes a humble attempt or a feeble attempt to get me to a meeting, but we can't find the number in the book. And I get on the train the next day, and scripted for disaster, good looking man, owns a sailboat. I was always after what I could get. And he's talking away, and I'm thinking, sailboat, be really nice to have at her door right now. And he goes, would you like to have a tea or a coffee or a beer, those magic words? And I said, oh yes, okay. I can't call my sponsor, there's no phone on the train. Call your sponsor before, not after. And I had a couple of beers, and I remember at 11 o'clock we docked and we pulled in the CN station there, and I had that feeling in my stomach of complete and utter I was so ill. I was so sick. And it wasn't physical. I could tell it was not physical. It was soul sickness. I had been in AA 3 months, 6 months. I don't remember. I think it was 6 months. And I'm still drinking. And, you know, I looked down on everybody in AA. I looked down on them all because I had lots of degrees of stupidity. And, I got off the trail, and I was vulnerable because, you know, I have no defense against the first drink. That's what it says in the book. Unless I pick up these spiritual tools, I have no defense against the first drink. And I'm at the corner of René Lévesque and Metcalf, and I'm going, take a cab home, take a cab home. You're downtown. Like, this is danger, you know. And the other part of me says, cabs are expensive. Take the bus. I get on the Dorchester René Lévesque bus, and who's on there but my best drinking buddy from Radio Canada, and he offers me lunch, and I'm off to lunch, and I have a few quarts, you know, because I steer him to the annex. I know where all the quarts are downtown. Like, why have a bottle when you can have a quart? And I have a few quarts, and I go to the meeting that night, because I'm still going to AA. AA's fun. Lots of nice people there. And my sponsor doesn't say anything, you know, but then something happened to me, and I think I could call it my first spiritual awakening, is that I told her that I had a drink that day. The first time I was honest in my entire life. I said, I had a drink today. A drink. I love that, a drink. I had a drink. And she goes, I thought I could smell it on you. And I thought, geez, these people are pure. I mean, I had that drink like hours ago. Well, you know, 8, 9 quarts. I don't know how long I was at the annex. I don't know what time I left it. I don't know. I went home. Maybe I brushed my teeth. Maybe I didn't. And I went to the meeting. And it's coming out of my pores. I mean, like, And she goes, I thought I smelled something or detected something. So I went and joined that meeting that night. That was the first time I actually stepped up and said, you know, take my name, I'd like to belong to this group. And the secretary said, day to your last drink, because he was a bit uninterested. And I said, noon today? And he was interested suddenly. He looked up. So I joined that group, and I had a terrible trouble with commitment. Like, don't ever hem me in. Don't tell me I have to be anywhere, because you never know, Hollywood might call. I said, I can't. I went to the business meeting. That's the next step. Join a group, you know, give them your name. The next step, show up at the business meeting. I showed up at the business meeting. And I said, Sharon, how would you like to greet? And I'm like, oh, is that 4 weeks in a row? You know, be out of town, might go to New York, you know. So they said, look, take the job, and if you can't do the job, you're responsible for someone to do the job. And I realized, great, I can do the job, and if I can't do it, I'll get somebody else. And I did, you know. And I stood there and I shook people's hands and I didn't know their names. They'd say, you know, I'm Kim, I'm George. And I liked it. I liked it. Because, you know, I'm basically a lonely extrovert. So I would go to that meeting every Thursday. I'd go to Monday Central. And I started slowly, because I was no big enthusiastic member here, I started to slowly be touched and moved by the speakers. They were funny. They were much better educated than I was, a lot of them. They were moving, and I just sort of got caught up in the whole going to meetings thing. You know, and I went to my business meeting downtown, and, you know, one day they asked me to thank the speaker. My God, I had cards. I took notes. You know, I had to be perfect. And I got up, and he turned out to have used the Scottish Grace that was in my house by Robbie Burns. And so I got up, and I said, you know, whatever I said, who knows. And I sat down, and people applauded, you know, and I was hooked. I was hooked. And that was my first summer. My real summer of sobriety was back there somewhere. But I wasn't thirsty now. I wasn't watching the beer ads anymore. I was going to noon meetings. I found about noon meetings. And I had a sponsor now. My sponsor would meet me before the meeting. And another thing happened to me, because I was really into the fact that I hated rich people. I hated money. I hated money because I didn't have it. It didn't matter. I held on to it, I guess. And she said, come, I belong to a private health club. You know, we can have a swim. I like to swim and get the bus, go downtown. I walk into the Four Seasons, and there's this big thing of flowers and this magnificent lobby, and there's somebody tinkling the ivories. And I looked around, and I know she was in there because it's a very big hotel lobby. And I thought, if this is sobriety, I want it, because it was the fact that I would walk into a place like that and not be going to the bar with somebody, you know, to pay for the drink. I was like going in there on my own steam, and I saw Susan. She took me up to the outdoor pool. We swam, and my sobriety and my living started to be complementary. You know, I started to see my sponsor almost on a regular basis, and she loved to swim, and I just got hooked. You know, if AA doesn't get you, if you come around here enough, AA got me. I didn't get it. It got me. And I got active in service at Monday Central. at that time I decided I'd like to have a show. I was a painter, and I was going to have a sale at my house, and I had the, you know, I planned the whole thing, and then I had like an attack of nerves. I thought I was seeing things, like that my toast was moving and stuff, and I said to her, and I called her at 1 o'clock in the morning, which I would never do. I mean, when, in the 70s, I tried to kill myself, and I was seeing a shrink, and I wouldn't phone him because it wasn't my day for an appointment. Like, that's how badly I saw myself and my worth and what I meant to people. But this time I phoned her, I said, I don't know what it is, things are moving, and she says, you know, you don't have to have this show if you don't want to. And I decided to go to the hospital, they checked me out, of course they couldn't find anything wrong with me, I was having an attack of nerves. I was doing this without a drink in me. And I had the sale the next day, and this lovely man came that I had seen around AA, and, you know, I started to talk to him, and what's neat about it was I wasn't madly in love with him, I just found him intriguing. You know, usually I was madly in love the second I saw them. I'm going to try to figure out why, but it didn't matter because it was destiny. And this man wasn't like that. He was, you know, he was intriguing, he was nice, he seemed to have a certain amount of sobriety, I guess. And I just, you know, started to see him in meetings, and I asked him to be my business manager, and I had the show, it was very successful, beyond my wildest dreams, really. And I got over the first hurdle of facing a seriously fearful situation without any chemical or booze inside me. And that was my passage to trying and risking and taking bigger steps. You know, I remember that phrase in AA that I love, you know, small steps for baby feet. I took little steps. And this was a big, big step for me to have a show. And it worked out. And I just, my life from then on became very much going to meetings. My whole life was going to meetings. And I would fit my concerts or friends or something in around the meetings. Because the meetings, I needed to have a lot of meetings. I needed to be very busy. I'm a very, I have a lot of energy. And if you leave me alone too long, I'm going to go get into trouble. I have a mind that will diagnose me and tell me I'm seriously ill. And within a half an hour, I'm trying to locate a shrink because my problem is so serious. And but by then, I was so busy, I couldn't call the shrink. I had to go make coffee, or I had a sponsee to meet. Or my whole life was dedicated to AA. And I finally did 90 and 90. I hadn't even heard about 90 and 90. One summer, I did 90 meetings in 90 days. And I started to go to conferences outside of town. I started to go to women's intensive weekends. And I think, you know, the first 4 years were tough because Sharon was a big problem for Sharon. I mean, I hated myself. Let's face it, I hated myself. I was so hard on myself. I had 1,000 bats. Oh, you did that wrong. Oh, you did that wrong. Bang, 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 bang. I was constantly beating myself up, you know. And one good thing about being busy in AA is I didn't have to think about myself. When you're up here chairing for the first time, you're scared. When you're asked to speak for the first time, it's scary. But you're busy and you're directed outward. And as the years went by, and I finished this degree that I was doing at university, I got the opportunity to go away and live by myself in an isolated place in the north of Canada. And I was absolutely terrified to go because I had all these safety nets around me. My sponsor and all these people knew me and my meetings, and suddenly I'm going somewhere and I don't even know, you know, I don't have that trust in my own sobriety that I'll stay sober. You know, I might drink. And when I was in the Edmonton airport, I thought of buying a package of cigarettes. It was so interesting because I thought, why do you want to have cigarettes? You haven't smoked in 4 years. And I realized, I'm nervous. I'm going into the unknown, and I need something, right? And I didn't buy that package of cigarettes, thank God. So I weathered a year by myself, and I can tell you that isolation taught me the third step prayer. I mean, I knew the third step prayer, but I did it every morning on my knees. I did it 12, 15, 18, 17, 25 times a day. And I had a wonderful experience up there. Came back to Montreal, had to start all over again in Montreal AA, like a newcomer. I'd sit at the back, and if they didn't recognize me, I'd say, I'm leaving, you know, and I'd say, oh, get off it, you know. You need AA, they don't need you, you know. Move up to the front, get involved again, find a home group, get active, and that was quite a few years ago, and I've been away since then, and I've weathered solitude because I have a program now. Because in one of the pieces of literature, Bill Wilson said, I have a program that will work anywhere under any conditions. If I have a fellowship and a sistership, my life is easier, but I have a program without a fellowship. Because I have this book and the program in it teaches me that on a daily basis, I am not alone in the world. I have a higher power who has my best interest at heart. And so all of those defects, I lied constantly. I started to have to go make amends for lies. You know, I had to go and look at my financial situation, realize it was all grandiosity. You know, I have to shop at Holt Renfrew. I have to have this. I don't have to have anything. I have sobriety. You know, I have a place to come where people need me, where I can serve. And if I, you know, all I can say is after the years I've been in AA, my life is about serving other people now. But I also know how to take care of myself. You know, in learning how to be good to myself, I've learned how to be happy, but I also am happy when I'm helping other people, because if my life is all about me, it can go to shit in 2 hours. You know, it can go to rat shit. So, and I had great sponsorship. They said things like, you know, you don't always get what you want, but you get what you need, and be careful what you pray for, because I pray for something and I get it, and I go, how do I deal with this? How do I do this? And I've had wonderful sponsorship in my fellowship. My sponsor that I had for many years, I love dearly. She gave me my 18-year cake on her deathbed. She died on my anniversary. I was bereft for a year. I knew what to do. I picked up the spiritual tools today. I went and got help. I went for grief counseling. That helped me get through the dark days. And then, you know, I stayed at work. That was distractions. Go to meetings, you know, start helping sponsees. Find some newcomers. And I get out of yourself. And I weathered that death. That was one of the most difficult deaths for me, because even though I love my parents, my mother died when I was 21, I was numb. My father died in sobriety. I had a good relationship with him. But he was a man who drank and smoked his way into, you know, he died at 81. He had a tremendous constitution, and I had a wonderful relationship with him. But when my sponsor died, I had a very difficult time. But I had to go and get another one, which I did. And if you're new in the program, if things aren't going that well, or, you know, you think this is boring, I mean, maybe I'm boring, but the program's not boring. This program's about you. So I got out of the program. I got out of the program what I put into it, you know. If I don't put anything into it, I get that old feeling nobody wants me and this is no good. Luckily, I've rarely left AA. I've rarely lost that enthusiasm for it, because it's me. It's who I am. It's my life. And everything, all the gifts I have, you know, financial responsibility, wonderful job, a fabulous marriage, all of that came from being sober. So I want to keep that sense of serenity and that sense of peace inside myself. And I can only get it here and in doing work for AA. So I want to thank you all for being here on a hot night, and I hope that you have another wonderful 24 hours of sobriety. Thank you.